The finalists for the National Book Award for Fiction will be announced next week. A few of the books on the long list: Alice MacDermot's Someone, Jhumpa Lahiri's The Lowland, Thomas Pynchon's The Bleeding Edge, and a beautiful novel by Boston College professor Elizabeth Graver, The End of the Point. The title refers to Ushant Point, a fictional strip of land jutting into the waters off Cape Cod, but it also refers perhaps to the end of a certain time. The book begins in the summer of 1942. The Porters, a well-to-do family, arrive to open their summer house. Their oldest and only son is enlisted. Many of their neighbors are staying away because the army has established a post at Ushant to scan the horizon for attackers. The young Porter girls, their mother, and Bee, the girl's nanny, arrive.
The army had paved the road. It was the first thing Bee noticed coming back with the Porters that summer when most other families stayed away. How the rutted dirt, grassy bumps, heaves and jolts were gone. Instead, a ribbon, gray and smooth. Mrs. Porter complained about it. The two older girls did, too. People will speed now, army trucks. A gash on the land, said Helen dramatically, a wound.
So we arrive at Ushant and will keep coming back over 5 decades, watching those girls grow and have children of their own. When we spoke with Elizabeth Graver, we asked her about the beginning of The End of the Point, which includes an excerpt from a book by the family's grandmother, Mrs. William Starr Dana. We thought she must be a fictional character as well, but no.
Mrs. William Starr Dana was a real person. She was my husband's great-grandmother.
Really?
Yeah. And she wrote this really lovely nature guide for children called Plants and Their Children. It's a little nugget of what I'm trying to do, which is to look at how people move through the generations and create the next generations.
Well, here's the first line. When I began to tell you children about the different ways in which plants send their young out into the world, I had no idea that I should take so much time and cover so many pages. Well, I'm thinking you might have thought the same thing. She goes on to say, you know, sometimes seeds are blown through the air by means of silky sails to which they're fastened or else by their little wings. Of course, the children in this book are those seeds. We watch them as they're blown into life from this first place that we meet them. But this idea of this growing and growing and growing, it grew till 5 decades for you.
It did. It covered quite a bit of time, although I actually originally thought it might cover more. But when I started to really work on it, I realized that the pulse of fiction, which for me is always the characters, in order to do that, I needed to go narrower and deeper.
Is this your family?
This is not my family. This is a fictional family, but if it has a basis in truth at all, it's much more based on my husband's family. No, my family were Jewish immigrants from Turkey. Nothing. That's my next book. The continuity is part of what was not part of my own history, but just fascinated me, the layers of building up in one place. What does that mean? And I think it's a gift, and I think it's also a privilege and a limitation in certain ways.
Yeah, well, talk about those. The gift part is that summer place ritual, the first dip in the ocean, standing to watch the sunsets, kids able to frolic and go anywhere.
Yeah, tremendous freedom and also tremendous sense of something being stable in a world where a lot is not. So my book takes place, as you mentioned, during World War II and during Vietnam, and there's just tumult everywhere, but there's this literally rock-solid, rocky piece of land, although it too ends up being subject to development and erosion and all kinds of things. So it's not as stable as it initially looks either.
Well, also, the people of privilege may not be noticing how not stable it is for, let's say, Bee, the help. You begin the story, I think it's going to be Bee's story. She's a nanny from Scotland who, as we said, takes care of the Porter's little girls and is so in love with one of them that she actually gives up a love of her own, one of the soldiers. So here's this beautiful, placid beach retreat, but not many people are aware of her story.
Right, and that really was part of what I wanted to do, was to kind of look at the quiet stories on the edges and look at this place through the lens of both insiders and outsiders and the position of the nanny or children's nurse, which it only recently occurred to me is a bit like the position of both an in-law and a writer, and that she's watching all the time. She's sort of part of the family, but not entirely. So I got very fond of her and her vantage point.
Well, I got fond of her, too. And then you abruptly pull the narrative away from her and give it to Helen, one of the girls, boisterous as a child, and suddenly it's her story.
Right. She's a little self-absorbed, but she, too, is struggling with how to make a life and with what this place means to her. She is an intellectual in a world where she's expected to have a bunch of kids, and she can't quite figure out how to chart a course for herself. So by the end, I was as attached to her as to be, I think.
That's Elizabeth Graver. Her book, which begins in 1942, is called The End of the Point. You're listening to Here and Now. We always hear about the simpler time. You know, those of us who don't have a summer home can't even imagine something like this, what that must feel like. Is this nostalgia for that time? Or?
Well, there's a lot of material objects in the book. I don't know if you noticed, but there's a lot of diaries and letters. And, you know, I do feel some sense of not wanting myself to lose track of the tactile world, not wanting everything to become virtual. I'm not sure if that's nostalgia exactly, but I feel anxious about the state of our planet.
Well, you have one character. Now, again, this is Helen, the small child we meet in the beginning. This is her son, named after her brother, who was killed in World War II, Charlie. And he literally becomes not just anxious about it, he's somewhat mentally ill.
Yeah, and he's really that voice, and he reads Emerson and Thoreau, and he becomes friends with a Vietnam vet named Jerry, who is also very unbalanced and has PTSD probably.
They're unbalanced, but they may be the wisest, you know, to see what's encroaching on the house.
They know what matters, and they're trying really, really hard to protect it.
When you're writing about young Charlie, are you conscious of his uncle who was killed in the war? Is he conscious, or maybe he's not conscious, but you are?
I was very conscious. And a few readers have said, you know, why are there several Charlies? It's confusing, which I can see. But to me, those echoes are everywhere. And Helen's relationship to her son, named after her brother, is colored all the time by her having lost her brother, even if she can't see it.
But it also got me thinking about my own family. And isn't it true that that's the way families are?
Definitely. I think that with my own family as well, and I see it in my own work. I remember once looking back at my first book, A Story Collection, thinking, why are there so many lost fathers and dead fathers? My father's at that point was healthy and lovely and alive, and then realizing his father had died suddenly when he was a little boy, and you don't quite know how. Is it in your genes? Is it in the stories you've been told? But I love the way writing itself, even for the writer, can carry these kind of unconscious echoes.
And that's Elizabeth Graver. Her book, The End of the Point, is on the long list for the National Book Award for Fiction. We spoke in April.